content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 11th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. Another interesting drawing on the front this week. It shows John Kelly, the new White House chief of staff, in his Marine gear, looking like a drill sergeant. And lined up in front of him are Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Jared Kushner, Steve Bannon, and then just at the edge of the picture, you can see a little bit of Donald Trump's profile. They're like new recruits, and he's giving them the business. Over his shoulder and going away and looking back is Anthony Scaramucci in T-shirts and shades and looking a little bit concerned. The title of the drawing says, "Taking Command, Can Kelly Impose Marine Discipline on a Chaotic White House?" And we will start with that main story. Embattled Trump turns to Kelly. What happened? Hoping to bring order to a White House beset by leaks and infighting, President Donald Trump this week replaced Chief of Staff Reince Priebus with Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, who immediately fired Anthony Scaramucci, the controversial White House Director of Communications appointed only 10 days earlier. Kelly, a retired four-star Marine general, won Trump's approval by successfully enacting the administration's tough new immigration and border control policies. Known for his strong leadership and blunt, no-nonsense approach, Kelly reportedly got assurances from the president that all senior White House staff, including Trump's daughter and son-in-law, would report directly to him. Trump called Kelly a great leader and a true star of my administration. Scaramucci was fired in large part because of an extraordinary expletive-laden phone call with a New Yorker journalist last week. The former hedge fund manager vowed to effing kill all the leakers in the White House and personally attacked Priebus, calling him an effing paranoid schizophrenic who had blocked him from getting a West Wing role in January. Scaramucci also denigrated White House senior strategist Steve Bannon, using a vulgar sexual term to suggest he was interested only in burnishing his own reputation. Priebus was forced out the next day, but 3 days later, Scaramucci, too, was gone. The personnel shakeup came after what was perhaps Trump's worst week in office. With a humiliating defeat on health care legislation, the Priebus-Scaramucci fiasco, a backlash against Trump's provocative speeches to the Boy Scouts and police, and growing resistance from fellow Republicans, Kelly immediately had to deal with his first leak. CNN reported that when Trump fired FBI Director James Comey in May, Kelly called the G-man and told him he was so upset that he was thinking of resigning. What the editorial said: Kelly's dismissal of Scaramucci represents the introduction at last of order to a White House run by novices, said the Washington Examiner. The mooch needed firing. As smooth and impressive as he was in his first and only press briefing, the Wall Street bomb thrower made his position untenable with his utterly idiotic, profanity-laced interview. By getting rid of Scaramucci as his first act, Kelly demonstrated he really is the disciplined and discipline-demanding Marine he has been made out to be. Kelly certainly has the capacity to be the adult in the room, said the New York Times. He has far greater managerial experience than Priebus and none of the political baggage. the former Republican National Committee chairman, brought on his own team of party functionaries and infighters. But Kelly's fate depends on whether he can truly control access to the Oval Office and temper Trump's worst instincts. How do you impose discipline when the president rage tweets at dawn and keeps blindsiding his staff with impulsive announcements and policy decisions? The chaos starts with him. What the columnist said. Trump's elevation of Kelly shows he is in full-on panic mode, said Trump biographer Michael D'Antonio in CNN.com. Braggadocious yet deeply insecure, the president has evidently lost confidence in his ability to handle the multiple threats he is facing, including a rebellious GOP, special counsel Robert Mueller's widening investigation, and a defiant North Korea. Having held a deep respect for strong military men since attending military school, Trump has turned to a retired general to instill some order and discipline. It may work for a while, but as soon as Trump feels comfortable again, he will likely revert to chaos. Kelly will certainly bring major change, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. There will be no more open-door Oval Office gabfest or kibitzers loitering in the hallway hoping to catch the president's eye. After a chaotic start, President Clinton saved his presidency by making Leon Panetta his all-powerful chief of staff, and Trump's choice of Kelly could have a similar result if the president listens to him, tweets less often, and stays focused. You really expect Trump to change? Asked Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Trump may finally have a competent chief of staff, but the president is still erratic, still impulsive, still ignorant of the basics of governance, and he'll continue blaming everyone but himself for his failures. Trying to control Trump's self-destructive impulses is inevitably a losing battle. After the farce of Trump's first 6 months in office, this may be the beginning of something much darker, said Dara Lind in Vox.com. While Priebus was always a mainstream outsider in Trump world, Kelly represents Trumpism at its most authentic. He has repeatedly echoed the president's belief that the U.S. is under attack from terrorists, gangs, and immigrants. Kelly's promotion, coupled with Trump's ramping up of culture war dog whistles like advising cops to rough up suspects, suggests the president is returning to his core campaign strategy, telling people to be afraid. With Kelly in charge, we'll find out whether a Trump White House can be functional, said Jonathan Swan in Axios.com. The new chief of staff has been granted unprecedented authority, is revered by all internally, and has no dog in the factional wars in the West Wing. If Kelly can't turn things around, this administration may be a lost cause. Controversy of the week, healthcare. What happens now? For Republicans, it's finally time to move on, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. The Republicans' seven-year campaign to repeal President Obama's Affordable Care Act finally came to a humiliating end last week with Senator John McCain's dramatic no vote, after GOP lawmakers produced a series of half-baked proposals that were as popular as throat cancer. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, a committee chairman, signaled this week that he's willing to work with Democrats on measures to stabilize and strengthen the current health care system rather than ripping it up and starting from scratch. The failure of repeal was entirely predictable, said Paul Krugman in NYTimes.com. For 7 years, Republicans claimed Obamacare was failing and that they would replace it with a system that would somehow lower premiums and deductibles while providing better care to more people. This was a web of lies. Obamacare has, for the most part, worked as advertised. And every replacement plan the GOP came up with would have raised costs, stripped coverage from millions of mostly low-income Americans, and handed a $1 trillion tax cut to the rich. Now that their stark dishonesty on health care has been exposed, maybe, just maybe, Republicans will work with Democrats to make the health system work better. The dream of repeal isn't dead, said Raihan Salam in Slate.com, at least not yet. In fact, Republicans are regrouping already around a new plan by Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy that would restructure Obamacare's insurance subsidies as block grants to give states the power to decide how health care funds are spent. For Republicans to abandon repeal would be to give up on everything conservatives stand for, said Avik Roy in NationalReview.com. What they need now is a full-throated agenda to lower medical costs by reducing government regulation and letting insurers offer cheaper plans covering essential care and emergencies. Customers would then enter the market voluntarily without the coercive, premium-inflating bureaucracy of Obamacare. Meanwhile, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com, a furious President Trump still wants to deal a death blow to Obamacare. Because of a still unresolved lawsuit from the Obama years, the president can unilaterally cancel the cost-sharing reduction, CSR, payments that help insurers extend coverage to low-income Americans. If Trump scraps CSRs, premiums in the state exchanges will spike by an estimated 19% nationally. That's if insurers don't decide to abandon the exchanges altogether. The Republicans who control Washington would be blamed for such a sabotage, but the vengeful Trump may not care. Like Samson chained to the pillars, Trump just wants to bring Obamacare's whole structure tumbling down, even if it might kill his presidency too. Protecting Obamacare is important, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. But if Democrats are bold and strike now, they may have a chance to achieve something truly historic. The failure of repeal confirmed that most Americans now believe in the goal of universal coverage, affordable, good quality health care for everyone. Democrats should push to expand the growing pool of Americans covered, perhaps by creating a Medicaid buy-in system that would serve as an alternative to private insurers. Thanks to social programs like Medicaid, Medicare, and the ACA, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, the U.S. is a more humane place than it was when tens of millions couldn't afford to see a doctor. Whatever Trump and the Republicans do next, the world before Obamacare will never return. Time for our good week, bad week, short pieces. It was a good week for the incompetence defense after Jared Kushner told a group of White House interns that his father-in-law's campaign was too disorganized to have colluded with the Russians. We couldn't even collude with our local offices, Kushner said. It was a good week for following in Rick Perry's footsteps after reports that former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was being courted to appear on the upcoming season of ABC's Dancing with the Stars. A TV insider said the report has legs. And it was a good week for bygones. After the Chicago Cubs awarded a 2016 World Series ring to Steve Bartman, the notorious fan who was blamed for costing the team a shot at the 2003 World Series by interfering with a foul ball. We hope this provides closure on an unfortunate chapter of the story, the team said. But it was a bad week for jumping the gun after U.S. Representative John Delaney, Democrat from Maryland, became the first contender to declare his candidacy for the 2020 presidential race. No serious candidate over the past 45 years has announced a presidential bid 6 months into a new president's term. It was a bad week for law and order after the entire four-person police force in Sandpoint, Alabama, resigned for various personal reasons. Town officials asked for calm during the transition and assured the roughly 1,000 residents of the community will not be in a lawless state. And finally, it was a bad week for the Devil's Brew after a British man was hospitalized as a result of drinking Satan's Shot Vodka, which is infused with the world's hottest chilies. "We don't want to hurt anyone," a spokesman for Satan's Shot said, "but we produce chili sauces. That's what we do." On the briefing page, we have the Great American Eclipse. On August 21st, the moon's shadow will roll across the U.S. as tens of millions of Americans witness a total solar eclipse. Why do total eclipses occur? Occasionally, the moon's elliptical orbit carries it directly between the sun and the earth, placing all three celestial objects in complete alignment. The moon's shadow then falls across the Earth's surface, ultimately appearing to blot out the sun entirely. The phenomenon isn't especially rare, occurring somewhere on Earth every 18 months or so, but from any single given spot, a total solar eclipse is observable only once in 375 years. This will be the first anywhere in the U.S. since 1979, and the first since 1918 to be visible from coast to coast. It will also be the first solar eclipse to be seen only on American soil since 1776. The path of totality will cross through a whopping 14 states, says astrophysicist Ethan Siegel. More than 12 million people will get to experience totality without ever leaving their homes. What will eclipse gazers see? It's a gradual process, beginning with first contact, when the sun and moon touch, explains NASA heliophysicist Mitzi Adams. This leads to the partial phase, when it looks like someone is taking increasingly large bites from the sun. Next is the actual eclipse itself, when the sun is totally covered by the moon. All that is visible then is the solar corona, the sun's gaseous halo, which peeks out from the blackness. Totality lasts from a few seconds to just over 2 minutes, depending on where you view it. The sun's brightness is the totality falls by a factor of 1 million. Temperatures plummet by as much as 20 degrees, and the winds fall still. Some animals react, Adam says. Cows may start walking toward the barn. Crickets start chirping. Indeed, the sheer strangeness of eclipses has inspired fascination and fear since ancient times. How so? For centuries, people saw eclipses as omens, perhaps as harbingers of doomsday. When anything extraordinary happens in nature, it stimulates a discussion about instability in the universe, says astronomer Anthony Avini. In Indian mythology, it was believed eclipses occur because the Hindu demon Rahu continually chased the sun and occasionally swallowed it up. The Babylonians, one of the first civilizations to study the cosmos, believed eclipses heralded the death of their king, By the 8th century BC, they had devised mathematical formulas that predicted them. To fool an impending eclipse, they dressed someone up, usually a condemned man, as a substitute monarch. Greek historian Herodotus credits the philosopher Thales with accurately predicting the solar eclipse of May 28, 585 BC. People realized there were patterns, said astronomer Tyler Nordgren. If it is a dragon eating the sun, then evidently the dragon works on a timetable. What's the timing of this eclipse? Beginning at 10:16 a.m. in Government Point, Oregon, the eclipse will follow a 67-mile-wide path from Oregon through Idaho, Wyoming, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, Tennessee, North Carolina, Georgia, and South Carolina, ending near Charleston at 2:48 p.m. Some 75 million people live within a 200-mile drive of the totality path, and large crowds are expected to gather in towns and cities along the route, snarling traffic and straining infrastructure and emergency responders. To prepare, communities are coordinating with government, law enforcement, and food vendors and ferrying in portable cell phone towers. Glendale, Wyoming, population 200, set up an airstrip viewing area to accommodate some 20,000 visitors. Eclipse watchers are advised to bring their own food and water and take appropriate safety precautions. The biggest shortage on the day will probably be porta potties, predicts geographer Michael Zeiler. Will scientists learn anything from the eclipse? They usually do. For example, reduced glare during the total eclipse of 1919 enabled British astronomers Arthur Eddington and Frank Watson Dyson to observe the extent to which solar gravity bends starlight, confirming a key prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity. This year, in a project dubbed Eclipse Mob, astronomers across the country will use special radio receivers to study the ionosphere, an atmospheric region between 46 and 621 miles above Earth, ionized by solar and cosmic radiation. Day-to-night ionospheric fluctuations can disrupt radio waves and communication systems. Ion reduction after sundown is one reason AM stations come through better at night. Are there other projects? In Citizen CATE, C-A-T-E, which stands for Continental America Telescope Eclipse, astronomers from coast to coast plan to splice film footage into the longest ever movie of a total solar eclipse, about 90 minutes running time. Their primary goal is to analyze the solar corona. Normally almost invisible, the corona is revealed in striking detail during an eclipse. It's a turbulent region with temperatures up to 3.5 million degrees Fahrenheit, swirling solar winds, and coronal mass ejections, scorching ionized particles that fly toward Earth, pummeling our atmosphere and sparking the aurora borealis. These ejections pose threats to astronauts, satellites, and ground-based technology, and generate powerful currents that can short out power stations, potentially imperiling the grid. CATE researchers have meticulously synchronized their specialized cameras. There's no chance for retakes until the next total eclipse in the U.S. in 2024. You have to be ready when totality starts, says astronomer Matt Penn, because you can't stop the moon. How to view the eclipse. It's not an old wives' tale. You can permanently damage your eyesight or even go blind by staring at an eclipse. The only safe way to view the eclipse directly is through sufficient eye shielding, warns astrophysicist Ethan Siegel. That would include specialized glasses designed explicitly for solar viewing, gazing through welder's glasses or goggles or a hood, where you need shade 14 or higher glass to be safe, or through a telescope or binoculars only if they're fitted with a specialized solar filter over the outer lens. Only during absolute totality is it safe to remove your glasses, Siegel says. During that all-too-brief period, if skies are clear, you can check out the sun's corona and regulus, an extremely bright star next to the sun. Siegel says that if viewing conditions are perfect, you might also see the planets Mars and Mercury ahead and behind the path of the sun, respectively. Time now for a few columns. We'll start with one from the U.S. Don't count on major tax reform. The government will give you a tax break if you hunt whales, or if you're a policeman who wants to retire early, or if you donate a painting to a museum. When congressional lawmakers take on tax reform, said Brian Fowler, they will face a nearly insurmountable barrier. Hundreds of tax breaks, each with special interest constituencies willing to go to the mat to save them. The nation's massive tax code provides special tax breaks for ministers, veterans, blind people, farmers, grade school teachers, life insurance companies, robbery victims, shipwreck survivors, art collectors, people with huge medical bills, and those who ride their bikes to work. To cut overall tax rates without ballooning the deficit, as Republicans seek to do, most of those special tax breaks have to be eliminated. But do elected lawmakers have the courage to stick it to the blind, the sick, ministers, or veterans? Probably not. They're even less likely to eliminate the massively costly deductions for mortgage interest and state and local taxes. What this means is that Republicans have little chance of forging a consensus on comprehensive tax reform. A simple tax cut that increases the deficit may be their only realistic option. This comes from the United Kingdom. Don't revive the cult of Diana. Here we go again with the worship of Saint Diana, said Melanie Phillips. Last week, British television aired a documentary about the late princess that featured her sons, Princess William and Harry, telling us about their grief, about how their lives were ripped apart when their mother died in a Paris car crash nearly 20 years ago. It was most deeply touching, but also unseemly. Wasn't the maudlin dwelling on sentimentality and neediness exactly where the whole Princess Diana thing spun out of control? Britain was a stoic society until Diana died, when the nation suddenly erupted into public keening, thousands weeping as they laid flowers and teddy bears outside Kensington Palace. Out went the stiff upper lip, in came emotional incontinence. Yet what were these people really grieving over? A media image that Diana had herself largely created. She expertly manipulated the press to portray her as the brave victim of a heartless, cold royal family, inviting all Britons who ever felt isolated to identify with her. Yes, she did good works for charity, but so did every royal before her, including her ex, Prince Charles, and without such attendant self-publicity. Some praise Diana for humanizing the royals, but if the British lion now yearns above all for someone to give it a cuddle, should anyone take comfort in that? And a How They See Us column. Russia sanctions hurt Europe. Germany's economy risks becoming collateral damage in the showdown between the U.S. and Russia, said Jorge Valero in Der Tagesspiegel from Germany. The Russia sanctions bill passed by the U.S. Congress last week contains several sensible measures. It imposes new penalties on Moscow for its election meddling and codifies Obama-era sanctions, so they can't be repealed by President Trump. But the legislation also provides for new sanctions to be imposed against any company that contributes to the development or maintenance of Russian gas pipelines. That means German firms helping build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea, intended to bring Russian gas to Germany without going through volatile Ukraine, will be hurt. German Economy Minister Bridget Zypries is now calling for the European Union to retaliate. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker backed her up. He told the Americans that the EU would respond within days, presumably with measures targeting U.S. energy companies. America first, Juncker said, must not mean that European interests come last. Bravo, Congress, said Pyotr Akopov in Russia's Vigzlad.ru. American lawmakers passed this legislation to punish Trump for his outreach to the Kremlin, but ended up handing Russia a gift. The Europeans had been divided over the Nord Stream project, but this intervention in their affairs will only push them to implement it. Europe feels doubly betrayed because Russia's sanctions had previously been a joint affair, negotiated between the EU and Congress, between the EU and U.S., so as not to harm either's interest. Congress has torn one more thread out of the rope that binds Europe and America together. Let's take a deep breath before lashing out at the U.S., said Klaus-Dieter Frankenberger in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung from Germany. The sanctions bill does explicitly say that any measures targeting energy companies can be taken only in coordination with allies in Europe. German companies won't be immediately punished. And if they do suffer, we should remember that German interests cannot be equated with European interests. Eastern European countries have rightly pointed out that Nord Stream 2 merely increases European dependency on Russian gas. We mustn't reward Russian power politics by allowing the West to be divided. President Vladimir Putin has been masterful in his response to the new sanctions, said Mikhail Rotovsky in Moskovsky Konsulets from Russia. His decree that the U.S.'s diplomatic mission in Russia be reduced by 755 people was timed perfectly, after Congress passed the bill but before Trump signed it. He is making it clear that he is punishing Congress, not Trump, and giving America a proportionate symbolic answer while refusing to get involved in sanctions war that nobody can win. But in a TV interview this week, Putin warned that further U.S. measures would bring a much harsher response. The question now is, will Putin's self-restraint be understood in Washington? And our in-depth article this week, The Last Word, titled Colliding with the Past. For a century, a Confederate statue had stood without controversy in this half-white, half-black Alabama town, said journalist David Montgomery. When a car crash toppled the memorial, residents had to make a decision. About 3:30 a.m. on a Saturday in July 2016, an on-duty patrol car with the Demopolis, Alabama Police Department proceeded along North Main Avenue toward West Capitol Street. It was a clear night, and nothing much was going on. There hadn't been an arrest for 2 days, and that had been for misdemeanor theft from a supermarket. The squad car rolled past the bank and the power company on the left, the town square on the right. Up ahead in the center of the intersection loomed a monument, a marble statue of a soldier, not quite life-size, elevated about a dozen feet on a granite pedestal. Negotiating the intersection required a slight swerve around the monument, but the police officer crashed straight into it. The impact of the Dodge Charger broke off the soldier at the shins and put him on his back amid the shrubs and flowers. Undamaged was the inscription on the base, "Our Confederate Dead." A sign at the outskirts of Demopolis announces City of the People, a translation of the town's name from the ancient Greek. The population numbers 7,020, 50% black, 47% white. This is the western part of Alabama's Black Belt, so named for its rich soil, but also intimately associated with the enslaved people who worked the cotton fields, then stayed on as free tenant farmers, and whose descendants drove the struggle for civil rights. Following the crash, the lieutenant on duty woke up Chief Tommy Reese, who responded to the scene. Reese, 52, who is black, wanted to get the facts out as soon as possible, before conspiracy theories could propagate. The car and the statue were removed quickly. As a consequence, few pictures circulated on social media, which unintentionally fueled speculation. By morning, it was already spiraling out of control on the internet, he said, spurred in part by people from other parts of the country. A leading theory was that the officer was black and had been paid to take out the statue. The news spread immediately by word of mouth, said Annie Braxton, 84, who had participated in voting rights drives and rallies in the mid-1960s at Demopolis Morning Star Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King Jr. once spoke. An African-American pastor at another church told me there was jubilation on the African-American side of town. The white side of town was conflicted. There was a faction that saw an opportunity to tell a news story about Demopolis, and another that wanted to dig in to defend an older version. Confounding the battle lines was one fact that everyone, black and white, could agree on. Until that Saturday morning a year ago, the soldier had stood guard almost entirely without controversy. Nobody protested him. Nobody celebrated him. It was only after he was gone that he mattered. Within days, Reese announced the findings of an internal investigation based on drug and alcohol tests, security camera footage, and GPS data. The officer fell asleep at the wheel. To protect the officer's safety, Reese refused to release his name or his race. Now Demopolis faced a dilemma. As cities around the country wrestled with whether to take down their Confederate monuments, Demopolis had to decide whether to put its soldier back up. The Southern Poverty Law Center counts more than 700 Confederate monuments and statues on public property, mainly across the South. The push to remove or rethink them gained momentum 2 years ago when Dylan Roof, who killed 9 parishioners in a historic black church in Charleston, South Carolina, proved to have a fondness for Confederate iconography. Demopolis' statue was erected in 1910. During a wave of post-Reconstruction Confederate memorialization that produced most of the monuments in contention today. Groups such as the United Daughters of the Confederacy led the effort. It was a time when Southern whites were reasserting their supremacy following a burst of African-American empowerment after the Civil War. This January at a council meeting was when the community's conversation about the statue began in earnest. More than 40 people attended, and the council members and mayor sat around an oval wooden table. African-American men represent 2 districts that are predominantly black. White men represent 2 districts that are predominantly white. A white man represents an evenly split swing district. John Laney, who is white and had been elected mayor several months earlier, has the sixth vote. One by one, people approached the table to argue for and against the Confederate soldier. Chief Reese had posted extra officers, but they weren't needed. As strong as the convictions were on both sides, they were expressed in a tone of mutual respect. I understand that in the eyes of some people, really all of us, that was an unsavory time and there were some horrible things done, said a man who wanted the statue restored. However, if you erase history, what are the chances of the next generation remembering? We are the city of the people, and that's all people, not just one people, said a woman against the restoration. Patricia Godwin, president of Selma Chapter 53 of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, defended the statue. That monument was put here as a gift in the spirit that after Confederate soldiers were gone, that monument would remain, she said, adding, "Be proud of your history." But whose history would hold sway? At the end of the evening, the council decided it was not yet time to decide. The members voted unanimously to reconvene a committee of civic and business leaders and direct it to mull the matter over for a few more months. Demopolis was founded 200 years ago by fugitive French comrades of the exiled Napoleon, and it was named for a democratic ideal. Residents take pride in the fact that during school desegregation in the middle of the 20th century, Demopolis distinguished itself from many of its black belt neighbors. Black children and white children were funneled into the same schools, and the habit took. Today, Demopolis High School's student body is roughly as balanced as the population of the town. Progress in Demopolis has been complicated, though. As recently as 2003, students at the high school attended separate proms. Black students would go to the sanctioned school prom. White students would be invited to a private spring formal. Yet current students can't imagine such a practice. Instead, together they danced the night away. The same spirit that integrated the schools carried into other aspects of civic life. I don't know what it is about this town, but at the end of the day, we try to make it happen, make it work, said Charles Jones, Jr., 53, an African-American council member. Yeah, there's still some socioeconomic oppression going on, but we try to get along. We like our 50-50 mix. Not only is the police chief African-American, so are his two predecessors, and the force is racially balanced. The fire chief and the building inspector are black. The first elected African-American district attorney in Alabama history in 1992 was a lawyer in Demopolis. And yet, when Jones was pondering a run for mayor in the last election, he hesitated, even though he had already printed some campaign literature. Demopolis has never had a black mayor. I sensed that the town wasn't really ready, he said. Philip and Debbie Spence invited me over for a pork chop dinner to talk about the statue. Philip was wearing a T-shirt printed with "Save Our Soldier," the rally cry of a small group called Friends of the Old Soldier. The shirt quoted Proverbs 22:28. "Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set." The Spences, who are white, made a point of telling me that afternoon their nephew and some African-American teammates on the high school football team had been over to swim in the backyard pool. After dinner, Philip, 63, an Air Force veteran, sifted through old photos of the monument. "Taking down the monument, to me, is equivalent to going into a cemetery and kicking over a headstone," he said. "A lot of the descendants of these men are still in this town, and I talked to them," Debbie, 59, said. "They are hurt." The Spences can trace 11 ancestors who fought for the Confederacy. John Holly Spence joined when he was 13 years old and was killed in action when he was 15, Philip said. He owned no slaves. They were poor farmers. And the way they looked at the war was they were defending their homeland. The monument, he continued, is not anything that glorifies slavery. It's just to remember people who died. You always want to remember your ancestors. The Spence's reverence for the statue was not uncommon, especially among an older generation of whites in town. Still, in the aftermath of the statue's fall, to hear white people wax eloquent about the old soldier was a stunning revelation for their black neighbors. I realized what it represented to them, and then I realized what it represented to me, said Braxton, the former civil rights activist. Bigotry. If we are the city of the people, it represents an exclusion of my people. Some white residents could not understand why, if the statue was such an outrage, black residents had been relatively silent about it. There never was a problem until somebody ran over it, said David McCants, a 68-year-old former council candidate. If you had hard feelings on it, why didn't you bring it up before somebody ran over it? Finally, in late April, the city council took up a proposal. Demopolis would carry on without its Confederate statue, but with a twist. The soldier would be replaced by an obelisk inscribed to the memory of the dead in all wars. The soldier would be placed in the Marengo County History and Archives Museum. The roll call proceeded briskly. The two white council members from the white districts voted against the proposal. The two black council members from the black districts voted for the proposal. Harris Nelson, the white swing district representative, also voted for the change. Mayor Laney abstained. By a vote of 3-2, the Confederate statue was consigned to history. Barone Langster, the pioneering black former district attorney, felt overjoyed, but he didn't show it. No one celebrated, and no one was in tears, Philip Spence recalled. It was almost like being in shock. He rose slowly to his feet to address the council. Tonight, y'all broke my heart. Today, the Confederate soldier is in limbo. In May, Alabama's Republican Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill forbidding the altering of any public monument older than 39 years. The council had little choice but to seek an opinion on the new law's impact from the state attorneys general, which is pending. Before I left the Black Belt, I found the officer who toppled the soldier and set Demopolis on its path of self-examination. He's no longer employed in town. He is African American. He said the accident happened the way Chief Reese reported. He fell asleep. I hate that it happened, he said. Regardless of what I say, nothing is going to change. I'd rather move on. And so would Demopolis. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the health and science page, we'll start with an article titled, Our Plastic-Clogged Planet. The world is filling up with plastic. In the first comprehensive assessment of global plastic production, researchers have calculated that humans have created an astonishing 9 billion tons of the synthetic polymer since 1950, and 7 billion tons of it have been thrown away. Of the discarded plastic, just 9% has been recycled and 12% incinerated. The remaining 79% is either clogging up landfills, littering landscapes, or floating in the ocean. The problem is only getting worse. Half of all global plastic production has taken place in the past 13 years. The researchers estimate that by 2050, there will be more than 13 billion tons of discarded plastic worldwide. The danger is permanent global contamination with plastics. Lead author Roland Geyer of the University of California, Santa Barbara, tells the Washington Post, "It's just going to be everywhere, in the soil, in the ocean, in the sediment of the ocean floor. Even the beaches of Hawaii now have plastic bits mixed in with the sand." A team of oceanographers recently discovered off the coast of Chile a plastic garbage patch bigger than the state of Texas, similar to the vortex of floating plastic debris in the North Pacific. Most plastic products, such as food packages, are designed to be used once and then discarded. Recycling rates remain low, especially in the U.S. Europeans recycle 30% of their plastics and the Chinese 25%, versus just 9% here. Dogs-friendly genes. It's a question that has beguiled scientists and pet owners for years. Why are dogs so innately friendly? New studies suggest that the answer may lie in a mutation in doggy DNA that is also found in a rare human disease that makes people extremely friendly. The researchers believe that as dogs evolved from wolves over thousands of years, humans encouraged the proliferation of this genetic change in the dog population through breeding. Scientists from Oregon State University conducted a series of experiments with 18 dogs and 10 captive wolves, in which the animals had to solve a puzzle when they were alone, with someone they knew, or with a stranger. The wolves consistently outperformed the dogs and remained more focused on their task, whereas the dogs became distracted by people. Researchers at Princeton then pinpointed differences in two genes in the two sets of animals. These same two genes have been linked to Williams-Buren syndrome in humans, which causes overly friendly behavior. Researchers Monique Udell says Williams-Buren delays cognitive development in humans, but works for the dogs because they have learned to get what they need from people. The very things that make life challenging for a human, she tells the New York Times, may make dogs successful. On the Talking Points page now, football, a disturbing new study. It seems crazy to imagine the end of football, America's most popular and profitable sport, said Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal. But both the NFL and college football were rocked last week by a disturbing new medical study that starkly reveals the long-term neurological risks it poses to players. Researchers at Boston University found that 110 of 111 brains donated by deceased NFL players showed signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, a progressive neurological disease linked to dementia, memory loss, depression, anxiety, and violence. Among deceased players of all levels, from professional down to high school, 177 out of 202 examined brains showed evidence of CTE, presumably as a result of repeated blows to the head. The study certainly got the players' attention. Baltimore Ravens offensive lineman John Urschel abruptly retired at age 26 to focus on his Ph.D. in mathematics. Pittsburgh Steeler quarterback Ben Roethlisberger said he was considering retiring after this season, noting, "You can't have a brain transplant." Even devoted football fans have to feel twinges of conflict now. "Actually, the results of this study are being overhyped," said Daniel Ingber in Slate.com. "All the brains in this study were donated because there was reason to suspect that the researchers might find evidence of damage. A more representative random sample would likely find a much smaller percentage of players develop CTE." Indeed, a 2008 University of Michigan survey of 1,000 retired NFL players found that most did not have classic CTE symptoms, although there were elevated rates of memory problems and dementia. Clearly, there is a link between football and CTE, but we haven't yet defined its scope and implications. As a former college player myself, I am deeply torn, said David Haugh in the Chicago Tribune. Football builds self-confidence and mental toughness and provides many impoverished young people with a free college education and a possible pathway to riches they wouldn't otherwise have. But the risk of brain injury is no longer debatable and requires the NFL to adopt rule changes. Restrict contact above the shoulders, for example. That will significantly transform the game. Fans, meanwhile, must accept that the big, entertaining hits they love can do terrible damage to players' brains, and that the game has to evolve and become less violent if it is to survive. A short note for you. Honolulu has become the first major U.S. city to pass legislation aimed at reducing injuries and deaths from distracted walking by smartphone zombies. Starting on October 25th, Honolulu pedestrians can be fined between $15 and $99 for looking at their phone or tablet while crossing the street. And we'll finish out with a quote from writer Annie Dillard, quoted in brainpickings.org. She says, "The mind wants to know all the world and all eternity, even God. The mind sidekick, however, will settle for two eggs over easy." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.